Gee, Yosus.
Tell the story about we were decorating for Christmas at the farm.
Yeah.
We had been putting out Christmas decorations. And that was just it was a delight, you know, for us, the girls and mom. But my brother Mike was just not happy about it. And of course, we had to roll up the great big rug, the braided rug, to bring in the fake fireplace that was kept out in Tunta's house.
My Aunt Ingeborg reminisced about decorating for Christmas. Tunta's house was a small storage shed where my great-great-aunt Bertha, who everyone called Tunta, which means aunt in Norwegian, stored her belongings.
We had to put these huge pieces of furniture on scatter rugs and slide them across the black walnut floor so that they wouldn't scratch the floor. And it was, you know, stuff that Mike just hated doing, but he was stuck with us, so he had to do it.
We were decorating, and we had this huge music cabinet that our grandfather had made out of black walnut, which is a hard wood. Black walnut is the only wood that doesn't float. It's too heavy. It sinks. And this thing was as tall as I was, with drawers, probably 16 drawers, maybe more, maybe 20. A 6-foot man could maybe look over the top of this thing. And it was heavy. I mean, it was so heavy. And of course, being young, I figured, I'm just going to muscle you, you sucker. And we're just, but no, can't do that because
you'll scratch the floor, you'll scratch the floor, you'll scratch the floor.
You know, so you have to lift it up on this huge rug and slide it. And as we're sliding it out of the way, because a paper mache fireplace that Herman had built goes on that wall with the socks, you know what I mean? And then in there was these wood that he'd found, and then a red light bulb that you plug in and it looks like it's on fire, you know? And I was not in the mood for this one bit. And as we're trying to get this thing away, you know, there's one kid doing the work and at least 3 or 4 adults giving advice. Yes. That's not needed, but is offered anyway, you know? And then once you get it, see, it was on that round braided rug.
Oh, we had to bring another rug in. We weren't
allowed
to put
anything.
Well, see,
I put it on the round braided rug. That was another thing because it started pulling apart, which I didn't like that rug anyway. It didn't fit in. You know, here's this majestic room and then Joseph's coat on the floor, you know, multicolored. Didn't make sense to me, you know, but anyway. So we finally got the thing moving, and as we're pushing it away, I just said, boy, I wish this place would burn down. And voila, a few, hour and a half later, it freaking did.
I think the direct quote was, I'd like to light a match to this place.
Could be. I didn't have to, though. No, no. I had arsonist intent, but I didn't have to go through it.
So you all thought at one time that you caused the fire. You thought that you had burned the house down with
my cooking.
Well, that's probably more accurate than anything else, you know. It's a conspiracy. It wasn't a plane. It was the oven.
Yes, there you go. My cooking felled the plane. That's what you, yeah, is how you put it, I think.
Yeah. Yep.
As I sat down to talk with my brother Ross, my uncle Mike, and my mom Sigrid in the summer of 2018, we laughed about many stories like this, about life on the farm with the characters that are my family. What we were trying to capture was how special life on Falling Low Farm was. There were so many stories and details that were shared, we had a difficult time narrowing down what to share in this episode. I honestly don't know how many of us there are in the family. There are literally hundreds and hundreds of us. But Falling Low was the one place that everyone called home. It was the heart of the family.
It sounds like Falling Low had a place in everybody's hearts. I mean, the entire family, because everyone...
That was home.
What didn't even live there, they still talk about coming back to Falling Low, and it was a big part of their lives.
Oh, yeah. That was the roots. That was the foundation of the entire family.
Yeah.
You know?
And that's pretty cool to hear. You know, it's great to hear your take on everything. But to hear up at the reunion up here this year.
Absolutely.
People that I'd never even met before saying, well, when I came to Falling Low when I was younger, it was like a magical place for because most people aren't used to a farm. You guys had a park, a rendezvous. I mean, everything that, you know.
I knew we were very special to be able to live on the home place. I mean, we were privileged. I knew that from the very beginning. There were people from Norway. There were composers that Uncle would invite, you know, home with him. I mean, there were always people at Falling Low. And Martha and her 10 children, they came for 2 weeks every summer. Elizabeth and the Olsons, I mean, everyone came to Falling Low. It was what you did for your vacation.
I guess the best part is that we got to meet all of our relatives. Anybody who was part of the Chernogle Andresen clan came by. So I'm number 85 of 85 first cousins. But, you know, I think I've met most of them because they all trekked to Falling Low. So that was amazing. And then aunts and uncles, and to think that mom is number 18 of 19 children, dad is number 10 of 11 children, and all those families and relatives, aunts and uncles, cousins, all of it. It was just a rich treasury of memories of these loving, wonderful people. What a blessing. What an absolute blessing.
And that they still called Falling Low home.
Yeah, the farm. There we went to the farm.
One thing over the years, I could never understand why people were so enamored with that place. Because me, it was just work, you know, mowing and chore and that. And then people would come, you know, and until later years did I understand that it did mean more to people than, but my perspective was different. You know, I lived there every day. So there are certain things. I hope this place burns down. I didn't have the appreciation for it, you know, because there weren't fond memories coming to visit, you know. There's the drudgery every day living there. You
know? Well, and knowing that company was coming was difficult. You know, we had to rearrange sleeping. I mean, there was one summer we didn't sleep in our beds all summer. We were on the porch or we were in the TV room.
Yeah.
You know, because these people came and then these people came and then that one came. And
what everyone remembers most of all is the time spent with one another on the farm together with family.
Some of the greatest memories, of course, playing pioneers with Sigrid and Little Stinker with Jerry and playing football in the birdhouse with Mike and Martin. And I remember, you know, Dad was at the hospital so often. We didn't really have to take care of ourselves. There was always an adult there, Herman or Ovidia or somebody. But, you know, we had to try and take care of things, you know, make it all happen and work. And it was just fun. It was really amazing. Charlene so close by and Paul, you know, down the road and Mary Ellen Moore's four boys were fun. Tim Mortwit, Marge McCoy, sometimes, you know, was out there and it was just great.
No more dairy cows going up and down the path between your pasture and your house. I miss that. No more sledding down the Chernicle Hill in the middle of winter. That was fun times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then the boys, Neil and Kenny and Gordy, I'm sure. And then Mike and Martin, they'd start hauling water. They'd make this great big run jump.
Yeah, so that your sled would go off and then down. So you had a little bit of a ramp.
And then they'd ice it.
Yeah.
And then yell, Sigrid, you can be the first one to go down. Oh, goody, goody, goody. There I go.
Thunk.
And Charlene standing there, no.
I saw it happen.
Yeah.
And then almost getting our heads. You had to be down, because if you went through the fence, there's barbed wire.
So you had to keep your head down. And then we decided,
well, gotta let's go down.
On a toboggan.
Not a good idea.
There was one stocking hat and two mittens on the barbed wire.
Oh, good times, good times. Luckily, nobody went, what? Oh, dear.
The rich history of Falling Low Farm physically began in 1864 when my great-great-great-grandfather, Ole Andreas Larsen Chernogle, began to build the structures that made up this incredible farm. Falling Low Farm was actually named in honor of Ole's wife, my three times great-grandmother, Martha Karina Anderson Falling Low Chernogle. During the second decade of the 20th century, the 240-acre operation of Falling Low Farm was widely regarded as a model farm of advanced design.
There were bigger farms, but not probably like that, because they got a reputation for selling purebred shorthorn cattle. And I remember people coming from Texas and buying calves and, you know, all over the place buying calves. I was pretty old before they started raising soybeans. It was corn, oats, and red clover. That was another thing. For some reason, Dad raised red clover hay. Everybody else, alfalfa, but he liked red clover. So it was corn, oats, and red clover for hay. It was all feed. It was all feed. Their main source of income was milk and selling cattle and then eggs, you know. We always had 500 chickens around that
Mike loved.
On a good day, probably you could get, in their peak, 452 eggs a day. I counted every damn one of them for years. And I'm not terribly fond of eating too much chicken now, you know. Love eggs, though, because every egg I eat is one less chicken.
As on so many farms, things grew and evolved as family members passed and needs changed.
Probably I was in maybe fifth or sixth grade when they finally sold all the shorthorns. Erling had probably passed away by that time because he was an integral part of taking care of things. And Dad was starting to get to the point where the arthritis was getting to where he couldn't do it. So they sold the cows. And then Dad one day disappeared, didn't know where he went. And that night he comes back with Cousin Julian and Uncle Chris. And they have the first Holstein bred heifer that a few days later had a calf, and then that's the cow we started milking. And I imagine Kennedy was in office because she got named Jacqueline, you know.
All the cows are named after presidents' wives. That was Herman's.
I love that. I had no clue.
Yep.
Was that Jackie?
No, Lady Bird.
Was the one that was our last one. Yep.
Say they named everything.
We didn't have anything that didn't have another name. Nothing.
All of your cars were named.
And all the cars were named. The humidifier was named. That was Obadiah. I had to water Obadiah every morning before the school bus came. Nothing had an original name.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Because there was Sweet Pea.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the car that you drove?
Yeah, that's the one I got in trouble with. The 1953 Ford. Yeah. Took it through the pasture. Mom coming after me, waving her apron. Yeah. Because there were stumps in there, and we could have, again, been killed. But I made a figure eight, so I was happy. And you could see it in the grass. I was probably 12. But I was driving for Dad. You know, I mean, he'd drive out of the driveway and down so Mom couldn't see, and then I'd take over.
My great-grandfather, Peter Gustav, and his brothers who worked and owned the farm didn't just focus on their farm work, but weaved their various hobbies and interests into farm life. Between 1914 and 1917, many journalists visited Falling Low Farm and provided incredible accounts of what they saw. What stood out and impressed visitors when they first arrived on the farm was a dried grapevine that spelled out Falling Low in large letters on the south side of the cattle barn facing the road.
It was ahead of its time being a split level. You didn't have to hoist the hay up to the second floor where the haymow was. You drove around to the west side and you unloaded it because they built it on a hill. And the haymow was the top of the hill. you know. And it was just ingenious.
Yeah, that was unique too, because you'd walk into it. The west wall was all stone, mortared stone into the dirt. And then the other side, you know, was out, and the cows were on the east side. And then in the middle were the calf pens, the baby calf pens with little stanchions, you know, that you could put a calf in to hold them and try and teach them how to drink, you know, which was a chore. And then in the back, oh, there was Noble the bull. He had a bullpen.
But what drew wide acclaim and attention was the concrete corn crib, the very structure that saved the life of my mom and family over half a century after it was constructed. On July 31st, 1915, the Des Moines Register featured Falling Low Farm to highlight the concrete corn crib, which fascinated and impressed the most experienced farm journalists of the day.
Most cribs would have been made out of wood back in that time. So concrete, it was a big, big job to get it.
Oh, absolutely. Only Vikings could accomplish it.
And they had holes along the bottom for airflow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, you know, the pillars on top. So it wasn't just poor.
There used to be, well, probably they got buried too, but back in that one pile, rock pile and stuff, the forms for those columns were back there.
My great-grandfather Peter Gustav said, just because a man is a farmer is no reason why he should lose his sense of the artistic and the beautiful. When we build a building, if only a chicken house, it is just as easy to make that structure attractive as it is to make it ugly. Peter Gustav was an accomplished woodworker and had a woodworking shop on the upper floor of the cattle barn. In 1915, he showed a reporter three chairs that he had recently completed made of wood from a native cherry tree. The reporter said, "They are about as beautiful pieces of furniture as one can find anywhere. It is impossible to buy anything like them in furniture stores."
So extremely talented in woodworking and all.
Oh, yeah. Well, really all that older generation, no matter whether they come from Norway or not, could work with their hands. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it was, you know. They didn't have any choice, you know.
The furnishings at the farm were absolutely such a deep part of our lives. The kubba stool made out of a log that was just as cozy and comfortable as a hug. The chairs that grandfather made shaped like violins. The music cabinet with, I believe, 15 drawers with the names of 12 composers inlaid in wood. The cabinet was made out of black walnut, and then the names were inlaid in oak so that they stood out. The Moonlight Sonata table, as Dad called it. The Mozart table. Huge, massive pieces of furniture that absolutely meant the world to the family and to the relatives. And when they came home, that's what they wanted to see. It was all in the music room, which had black walnut floors that, of course, our grandfather had laid, I'm assuming. And then Grandma's and Tanta's huge, huge braided rug that lay over it on the east side of that room.
Everyone on Falling Low Farm made quick transitions from working on the farm to the fine arts. Every member of the family played three or four instruments. During the early 1900s, the Chernogle Family Orchestra would tour extensively, performing a wide range of compositions, including pieces by my great-great-uncle Nehemias, known as Unko. All the musicians on the family were self-taught, and music was a huge part of family life on Falling Low.
You hear about the musicianship. Where did everybody play?
In the music
room. In the music room.
Mm-hmm. And
many people came from around to play there? Or
no, it was a family orchestra.
It was family, but then it grew to be a neighborhood.
Yeah, then other people would come and play too. And Dad, as a young guy, he always told me the best thing that ever happened to him, he lost his finger. And so that meant he couldn't play in the orchestra anymore because he played the clarinet. And he was so happy. He hated it so bad that...
So when people would come and play, it was a big deal. everybody came in and listened. And
yeah,
it was probably your Sunday afternoon entertainment thing after church, you know, that kind of thing.
But they traveled a lot too. Mm-hmm. The orchestra traveled.
Oh, wow.
They were well known.
Mm-hmm. The family's unique creative perspective also impacted their work on the farm. From the way they baled hay in an artistic spire to their innovative construction techniques, Falling Low Farm was well known throughout the area.
What I find that's so fascinating, like with that corn crib, is why did they put it there? And to me, it's nothing more than God, this is where it's going to be, because we need it there so many years later.
The plane crashed right behind the crib. And probably that's what spared the house from getting the full blast, you know, not only the jet fuel flowing out, but then the
concussion,
the fireball, and
yeah, that kind of stuff. Because just to the south of the crib was a gleaner combine that was rolled up into a little tuna can, you know, and the crib took that and it burned for weeks.
In April, it was still burning.
So all of the year's harvest was basically still in the crib.
Yeah.
So that sat and smoldered for 4 or 5 months. So all the time and energy and money that was...
Yeah.
That's the farmer's bank account right there, basically.
Right. Yeah.
The family being spared from the brunt of the blast wasn't just because of where the plane hit behind the corn crib that was made out of concrete instead of wood, but also because it was December, when the crib was full of 10,000 bushels of grain, which was the yield from that entire year's worth of work.
Let's see, the crib was totaled right away. The west end of the east barn was caved in, I remember.
And structurally, they said it would be impossible.
And the big barn, that was askew. And I don't remember, what about the stabur?
That was completely off the foundation.
Okay. And then the big house burned right down into the basement. A couple of days afterwards, we walked and looked down in the basement and we saw the freezer. You know, it had survived, but it was really charred. Probably didn't work anymore.
No.
And then the car had been parked out there and that was burned. What was that? A 64 Chevrolet?
64 Chevy.
Yeah.
Well, there was a Buick too that was...
That was Herman's. Okay. Yeah.
That was in the garage. Yeah.
And it burned too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Because the garage was right down there by the crib, you know, and that kind of stuff.
Their income for the entire year was burning 100 yards from their home that was reduced to ashes, along with centuries of irreplaceable heirlooms and family history.
I just kept saying, it can't all be gone. It just can't all be gone. I would not believe that it was all gone. And Mom and Gert spoke Norwegian, so I knew it was kind of intense. And finally, Gert said, get in the car, I'm going to take you out. I think this was like Wednesday or Thursday. And there were people all over the place. It was covered.
It wasn't until, oh my goodness, at least a week later, probably more like a week and a half, before I was allowed to go back out there and see, oh, everything is gone. And then sifting through stuff, you know, to find anything at all. We found some dishes. I was named after Grandma Chernogle, of course. And she had left me a cake plate, you know, crystal cake plate. And I just kept fantasizing that that would be the one thing that survived. Of course, it did not.
And there were things missing. The dinner bell, remember the dinner bell by the side of the house? That was taken, and there were things from some of the buildings that were taken that we knew were there at the time of the fire. Martin evidently saw the bell. It had fallen, of course, but, you know, it was still there. It was very shortly after that that the National Guard was called in again to keep people off because they were missing a lot of plane parts, but they were worried about, you know, some evidence of what happened from the plane.
After the loss of their home, the farm, their business, the handcrafted furniture, the family compositions, the instruments, the heartbreaking loss of Grandpa Pete, which was followed by the passing of our beloved Aunt Bertha, known as Tanta, and my Uncle Mike's impending departure for the Vietnam War. Now they were about to face an unthinkable 4-year battle with the government. Once again, here is my double cousin, Rebecca Hansen, reading from my Grandma Marie's account, which was written for the 25th anniversary of the crash in 1993.
Adjutant General May from the Iowa National Guard came to see me. He was dressed in full military attire with many decorations on his chest. Very impressive. His driver introduced us, we shook hands, and he said, "Who are you going to sue?"
Next time on Falling Low.